IT businesses in Sacramento, California.
From somewhere deep in the cloud and the corners of the earth, this is the Killing It Podcast, with a focus on helping you make sense and dollars of all things IT, with your hosts, Dave Sobel, Ryan Morris, and Carl Polachuk.
Welcome to episode 89 of the Killing It Podcast. We're back on track with that, I just got to say.
Well, you know, you'd think after this much practice. We are, well, you know what, so really, we're staring down episode 100 is not too far
I know.
Away. Like, we're
89 gonna get is forward. Very, very, it's too bad we can't get to 100 by the end of the year. We'd have to like double up seriously, so.
Yeah, and we have like, we have stuff to do, and you guys, plus the listeners really do not want to hear twice as much in a week. No,
it's not for any shortage of interesting things to talk about. It's just for that. Like, seriously, do I really want to listen to you for that many hours in a week?
No,
I have to admit, I actually don't have anything else to do. So I'd be cool to just hang out.
There are some clients who hear from me so much in a week that they're like, I'll pay you more to stop talking.
Exactly. Please stop talking to me.
That's not a bad idea. So speaking of paying us.
Well, this week we are sponsored by PCmatic, endpoint security built on a zero trust philosophy, allowing only trusted applications and blocking all the rest. Lightweight, simple to deploy, easy to manage. Find out about PCmatic's unique lead sharing program for MSPs backed by a primetime national TV campaign. Together, we bring advanced security solutions combined with more than sales enablement. We bring actual leads. Find out more about PCmatic by visiting PCmatic.com/MSP. And so I will take us into our first topic then. So this one kind of hits two of my favorite areas at the same time, because it combines technology with what I would sort of say is public policy as we think about larger society. Headline, AI reveals vast racial inequalities in New York City home ownership. The Center for New York City Neighborhoods uses their insight to try and focus on policies designed to increase Black home ownership. And they've done a bunch of analysis combined with the analytics company SAS to look at the higher proportion of homeowners having lower home values, even when the age and square footage are the same, based on Black and Hispanic ownership versus other racial groups. This is not the first in this line of insights that's coming into the way we're looking at data. I've been looking at stuff post-COVID, talking about the impact stuff that's coming out from a data perspective as it happens on different racial groups. There's some new studies happening around the impact on earnings over time. But what really gets me about this is that it is the use of AI to suss this out. That's what I love about using this kind of data to attack the bias rather than worry about having it.
I find it interesting that there's an entire agency that's this seven-letter acronym, Center for New York City Neighborhoods. But you know, it's interesting that New York was one of the areas that originally started redlining neighborhoods, and that was really intended to just inform insurance agents about neighborhoods where things are, you know, a little less troublesome, and so they can charge less for insurance. And that redlining became the discrimination tool for like 30 years. And finally they said, well, you can't do that anymore. So it's interesting that they're so completely aware that they've got this issue that they have to tiptoe around, you know, sectioning off neighborhoods and calling them out, because that had many, many unintended consequences.
Well, and if you really want to ever go down a truly horrifying rabbit hole in this world, Google your city where you are and redlining and look into the history of things that have gone on. We spent a very disappointing afternoon one time reading the original neighborhood descriptions and the bullet points underneath that were used in that redlining process to indicate, you know, in Seattle, this neighborhood is excellent. This one is not excellent. You look inside and you try to figure out why. And oh my God, the things that you read that they just wrote, this was government documentation, insurance industry documentation. It was published. It was, I was shocked and amazed and yet not really that surprised because you've heard about it, but it's out there. I think that those kinds of things will be easier to find when AI is not programmed to look for them, because what we do not understand is the new ways that those kinds of trends and biases in the financial system, in whatever dimension you're looking at, like if you find a way to prevent the bad behavior today, then somebody's going to get creative and come up with a different way. And then it'll take you a while to find that way. And then you have to cross that one out and they'll find another one. It's kind of like all of the bad behavior on social media. If you're just going after it one after another, you can't keep up with how creative they are. AI applied to this type of a thing, it's going to find the anomaly and then seek to understand why and what is the cause. The fact that we don't know what cause and effect is yet is secondary. The fact that you see that there is an effect, that's the thing to be paying attention to. I am fascinated by what this shows, but also by that next level of how AI in analytics, in data processing, can actually uncover things we didn't know we were looking for.
Right. And of course, the other piece about it is, you know, it's one thing to say, well, we stopped doing that, but it's another to actually start repairing the damage from that. And right. By actually applying data to this, I mean, it is a step in the right direction. I don't want to sit here and go like, oh, this will solve all the problems, because we have to strategically deploy policy, effort, programs, money against making changes to execute it and make it different. But at least we've got the ability to start tracking and testing against it using data.
And as we've mentioned here before, the AI can be biased because it's written by biased, faulty human beings. So, you know, but the fact that we're aware of that, like we're aware that the AI might be biased and we're saying, okay, so what weird stuff are we finding here? It's also the case that once you find things, you have to realize a lot of what people, you know, refer to as systemic racism, it's just we've built laws and structures and policies and procedures, and intentional or not intentional, they have a result. And that's, you know, finding that result and sort of squirreling back, like, why does this happen? Like, why is it drawing this particular line? What else is in the system? And so beginning that investigation, New York is probably a great place to start because there's so much data.
Yeah.
Right? And much harder in a smaller city.
Well, and that's the thing. If you can figure out models there and then apply them to other places, then it can be much faster to identify similar patterns. As a group of data nerds that we are on this conversation, this stuff, One of the most interesting things I learned about the research and analysis process was that you don't know what the data is going to show you until it shows you. What are we looking for? Well, sometimes you don't know. You just sit down with a data set, you look at it, you go, well, that makes sense, and this doesn't. And then you identify something. And when that happens, it was the same reaction that my brain had when I was like in the sixth grade and I actually understood algebra for the first time. That like, wow, I can see colors and I can taste flavors now. My brain went, whoa, I got it. That is fascinating in data analytics, and AI is going to make that happen an awful lot more rapidly. I am very excited about that kind of a use case.
Well, and by the way, you know, this is also useful to highlight is like, hey, this is an example of applying this technology to a really hard problem. You know, and I would say, you know, in this particular case, this is done kind of in a not-for-profit and with volunteers, which is to be absolutely applauded. The example also shows the way that you can do this in business, you know, the way you can actually apply this to those tougher problems and ideally start to remove the human bias through systematic approaches to it and understanding of obviously understanding algorithmic bias, but you can address it to drive that bias out.
And this is becoming easier for everybody to do. We have public databases that are just rich with data. And essentially free tools, Power BI and R and other tools where you can just download these databases and start running some stats against them.
Yeah, you can run stats against pretty much any data. It
seems. And you would have to be a special kind of nerd like we are to do that in your free time, but trust me.
Hey, I'm sitting right here.
I know. I resemble that statement.
This is what we do for entertainment. What are you talking about?
Exactly. All righty. So topic number two today makes me harken back to my youth. So when I was a kid, Dixie Lee Ray was governor of Ryan's state of Washington when I lived there. And Washington State had this history that every time they built a new power plant, which is to say a hydroelectric dam, the cost of electricity went down. And so when nuclear came along, they said, I know what let's do. Let's build 6 nuclear power plants all in the same place. And the cost of electricity will just dramatically drop to zero. Well, they decided to build 7. They never finished any of them. And the nuclear, the Hanford nuclear systems are just still sitting there. And the cost of electricity went through the roof. And so that's, you know, kind of a lesson on how not to do it. And in the meantime, solar power has just gradually and slowly taken over the world. And we're going to link to an article that has got some amazing, startling statistics about how electricity, the, you know, different sources have changed over time, except for coal, which basically hasn't changed over time. But solar and wind have become dramatically cheaper. Solar, the cost of solar power dropping 90% in 10 years, and the cost of the technology just becoming dramatically more efficient over time. It's quite alarming. I mean, it's
The efficiency differences and the cost drop was what just blew me away on this. Because I mean, you kind of like, I feel like I keep in touch with this space and think about it at some level and know, oh, it's getting better. And then you look at it and go, wow, I did not realize how much better and how much of that. I mean, it really does open up this thinking of like, it makes it clear why we should be investing more and more into solar because of just the dramatic difference of it. It was expensive a decade ago. It was an expensive way to do it.
Right.
Now it's not by massive amounts.
See, and again, these numbers are of a level that make you go, that can't possibly be legit. Let's look into it more closely. And it is actually legit, right? There's a chart in here that when you guys read through it, the cost of electricity from solar in a 10-year period declines by 89%. The price of onshore wind electricity declined by 70% in the same amount of time. Now, there's tremendous complexity in climate research and climate policy in all of the technologies that are associated with this problem. We get it, right? It's a big, important issue, but it has taken a long time to fix it because it is incredibly complex to solve these things. But when you can take 90% of the cost out and 99% of the cost of the equipment out over a couple of decades, well, this opens up an entirely new set of conversations, right? It's we learned in econ in college how, you know, the cost of building a new power plant is so expensive that utilities will often go to their customers and say, instead of let me build another plant so that I can provide more electricity to meet capacity, they'll come to you and say, here are ways that you can decrease consumption of my product so that I don't have to build more capacity because it will take me so long to recoup the cost of that investment. It's one of the very few industries where they will tell you on purpose to consume less of their product because it's so expensive. And now you can put this stuff on your roof. You can put this stuff in your backyard. Wind turbines, the local, like what we will call urban wind turbines that are like the spiral shape, not the big wings. Those things are very, very efficient and interesting. And now you look inside the economics and you're like, oh, now we're having a whole different conversation.
Well, it took them a long time to get here, but you know, ultimately it is technology that drove the price down. the technology of some of these older fuels just hasn't changed much.
Well, the other thing, but that's it's interesting to link that to, and I feel like the public policy wonk lately, but this idea of if it's changing this quickly, what that also means is from an incentives, from a taxation, from an energy policy perspective, it's happening way faster than we are normally set up for to create incentives in the marketplace as well as respond to it. And I would say that, you know, we as technologists need to put on our hats here and kind of make sure that our lawmakers are aware of this, because they're going to need to find ways to be way more agile. You know, for example, maybe tying policy to the cost of delivery much more closely, or, you know, to a set of metrics that allow them to be more dynamic, because we know, particularly when it comes to energy, this is a space driven not just by the technology, but the policies around it.
Well, and we are all consuming, whether we know it or not, less electricity than we used to. I mean, you look at your just replacing your light bulbs with LEDs. Right, we're all producing less heat with our light bulbs, but also consuming less electricity. And the other thing is sort of related to this is the cost of storage batteries is also plummeting. So it is interesting to see that over time, you know, things like, you know, all of the government programs to give you money back on this and that if you try these alternative energies, they're not alternatives anymore. Like those are the main stay energies. I think most of the government programs to give you rewards for putting in solar have disappeared, right? They've all expired. And in some ways, I guess that's appropriate now that we've reached this stage, right?
Yeah, now that it's actually competitive on a price, you don't need any incentive.
If you are hurting yourself to still be burning coal to make electricity, that's kind of on you.
Yeah, I'm clearly doing something wrong if your power bill is going down.
Exactly. But see, and this is the thing, right? If as technologists and people who run these systems, again, I learned a long time ago, if you sell server storage networking for a living, if you monitor and manage data centers and networks for a living, and you don't sell the battery backup and the UPS systems, you're just leaving money on the table. And it's amazing how many technologists don't pay attention to power and cooling inside the infrastructure. But I have become fascinated over the years by not just the generation of power with alternative technologies, but also that battery storage that you mentioned, Carl. I find battery technology to be remarkably difficult to develop and improve capacities. You know, we all complain that, you know, everything in your computer is 1,000 times more capable than it used to be, except for your battery that you have to continue to plug in. And there are reasons why, right? Like there's things at like chemistry and the permeability of cell walls at certain temperatures and frequencies. And nobody wants to know about those details. But as a technologist, you need to be aware of how to keep your customers online. And the fact that battery systems are radically improved in capacity and radically reduced in cost, this brings new ideas and new opportunities for remote computing. And, you know, we've talked before about that Microsoft example, the data center in a trailer kind of a thing. And we'll put a data center wherever you want us to put one. Well, as long as it has power, well, hey, now solar and battery, that's the least of your challenges in that kind of a solution.
Well, the other thing is I've got a friend that he's a Macophile, and he was talking to me, should I replace my machine now that, you know, they've got this new chipset, right? And it'll be so much more efficient and da-da-da-da-da. And I said, well, I'll tell you what, you're going to save more power by just getting rid of your spinning hard drive, right? You add the new chipset and get rid of your spinning hard drive, your battery is going to last easily 15 hours because there's nothing mechanical going on inside your computer anymore.
Well, now you've also thrown a couple of variables into there, particularly because that particular chipset on the new Macs is so much more lower power consumption. Right. You've got a couple. You're completely right on the moving parts, but we've also layered so many things. It's like, yeah, that guy should get a new computer.
If you have a spinning hard drive, you should get a new computer.
Right, yeah, you are definitely in the qualification of time to get a new computer.
Exactly. I have some PowerPoint slides I could show you about how much better life is with solid state. Excellent. So if we are good on that topic, let's jump over to our third topic here. And this one kind of fits within our conversation trend of what will be happening in the post-pandemic world. The topic that we're going to be featuring is the emerging realities of IoT devices and objects, things that are connected by sensors in remote working environments, but specifically the opportunity for a managed service provider to come in and manage the edge of the network that provides the remote access to these devices. The article that we're going to link to here, it makes just an incredibly compelling point. Where there is mystery, there is margin. Where there is complexity, there is opportunity. And apparently at the edge of the network, when we are talking embedded systems and IoT devices, there is no consistency or universal operating system yet that dominates the marketplace. There's many different flavors of operating systems. And as we all know, in a managed services world, you introduce multiple operating systems. Now you've got different monitoring processes and you've got different remediation processes, and it makes everything harder. Well, when that network gets that difficult to manage, they're not going to do it themselves. They're going to hire an MSP to take care of this stuff. I think this is a bright, shining light of opportunity, just a real flash that an MSP needs to be paying attention to. If you hear anybody say the word IoT, your first question should not be, I don't understand IoT. Can you teach me something about that? Your first question should be, let's talk about your network at the core and at the edge and make sure that that thing is robust enough and stable enough to do what you're trying to do, and that somebody is actually watching that network environment. I think it's just 1+1 equals managed service providers are about to get paid.
See, edge computing is one of those topics where I just kind of have to laugh and go, have we overnamed things? You mean a computer on the network at the last one? Like, that feels like edge computing. Like, wasn't that this? Why is this different than like my computer? I mean, like, I get, like, there's this sort of over engineering bit to it. Now, look, I get the idea that what we're saying is we're going to put some smarts into the devices. I get that. But this sort of sit, like, this whole conversation around like, oh, there's all this edge computing. It's like, yeah, it's called computing, right? Like, it's just computing across the network. Doesn't make as much sense. But what I want to actually focus on, that's not the rant I want to do. The rant I want to do links to the one that you've already kind of alluded to, is this idea of operating systems being much more diverse. I still rebel for a long time against IoT, like the worst named trend ever, right? This is just sort of like, although I've named lots of things the worst ones ever, this is one of those areas where, like, there are so many operating systems, there's so many classes of devices. I really just want you to start thinking about everything as smart and how you're going to manage all of these things, right? I will say that over the last 5 or 10 years, my thinking has changed, that I used to profess the idea of manage everything. And I think now I'm moving more toward the idea of policy entry points, like policy data. What I really think, getting to the point now, is I'm going to go, you know what? There's just all these machines I'm not going to trust. Like, I just don't trust them. But I worry about accessing the core data. I worry about accessing the systems that I do care about. Do they have just the minimal access? Do they have just the proper access so that if crazy stuff happens out there, I'm not going to worry about that? But this is a really big shift in the way you think about things.
Well, it used to be way back in the day, like when we each started our first business, there were a lot of different protocols you had to know. And it kind of winnowed down to TCP/IP. And now my favorite part of this article is there's like 4 paragraphs where it's all numbers, percentage, 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 percentage. And when you read through that, it's like, holy smokes, we have more protocols than ever. Like there's been this explosion, and it's been a shift. It's not like we went back to NetBUI. No, we're once NetBUI's gone, it's gone forever, right?
Right.
But even to look and see that 51% of the traffic is on HTTP and HTTPS, that's kind of stunning, right? Like that protocol makes a difference. So if you're not taking care of it, and to me, all I care about on the edge is the firewall. As long as you can at least begin to control it, you have a hope.
Yeah.
But if you put the management on every individual device, you just make your life far more complicated.
But let me observe that the reason so much is on HTTP and HTTPS is because developers got tired of trying to deal with security, and they just said, well, everybody allows the web out, so I'm right. just going to ship all my stuff over HTTP and HTTPS.
Right, and have an agent where it starts on the inside, so the firewall lets it through.
Right, exactly. Good to go. In a way, you've kind of made my case for, like, you can't trust any of these devices anymore because the system that was put into place to establish trust, well, we broke it because it was so locked out.
You can't trust it with a $39 firewall. You need to have deep packet inspection, and you need an expensive firewall.
Well, and again, this is, so the very first thing I was ever taught about networking when I was selling for a networking vendor many, many years ago was there are two kinds of people in this world. The ones who want to open up everything on the network so we can go anywhere and do everything. And then there are the people who want to lock down everything on the network and make it totally secure. Business people want open and usable. Technologists want closed and secure. Your job is to negotiate the difference between those two attitudes. I think we live in a world right now where the traditional technology professionals are looking at this like you are, Dave. That's way too many protocols. That's way too many devices. It's overwhelming in terms of complexity. And there's no way that you can manage all of those things in real time. And yet, that's where this world is going in the future. We are going to have a sensor and a chip that connects to the network in everything, from not just your computer and a camera and a wireless access point, but also your refrigerator at home, as well as the front door sensor in the office and every last minuscule little thing you can imagine. That is the magic of IoT. My philosophy is, if it's hard, I really, really want to figure it out, because then I can charge a lot for it. And I can actually give customers access to the unlimited possibilities of IoT without completely hosing the security and the stability of your core network. I think that's why it needs to be an edge conversation, not a core conversation, because to your point, Dave, it's not just a computer at the other end of the network anymore. It is everything you can imagine, from industrial devices to office equipment to facilities equipment. Everything that's out there is going to have a CPU, and it's going to have a radio that connects to the network.
Yeah, and that's just the reality of this. Is you just have to embrace that, like, that is the world, and you don't get to control all the devices anymore. You now have to switch to I'm going to protect the core data. And I'm going to make sure that only that stuff is allowed to the proper bit. And, you know, we can put names on whatever we want, right? It sort of doesn't matter. Is it edge computing, not edge computing, smart device, smart, whatever. It doesn't matter anymore, because this is, you know, it is irrelevant for the way you actually should approach this. Like, there's just things
out there. It's a serious heads up that if you're not training on this stuff, if you look at it and you say, MQTT and TCP/IP. My staff don't know those things. My staff can't spell TCP/IP, right? Then you need some serious training, because you are losing money by not understanding what's going on your clients' networks.
Right. And by the way, we can charge for this podcast to teach them how to spell that and add the slash.
In which direction that slash goes, right? Again, I think there's upside. I think that it is a space where a managed service provider can take one more step beyond the core Windows or Microsoft stack and into the rest of the operation. As I've said before, not just IT or OT, all technology.
Right. And look, I mean, you've queued up for the rant of like, if you're just looking at Windows, whoo, Nelly, you are not watching the whole bit. Like your world needs to be way bigger than just thinking that. And so that's a good place, I think, to wrap this one up.
Very good. Well, that will do it for episode 89 of the Killing It, podcast.
Thanks for tuning in to the Killing It podcast. Please share with your friends and tell everyone to subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, and all the podcast places. Join us next week and help us keep killing it in the technology business.